Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode number 10 of the Driving Eureka podcast. This episode is a deeper discussion on Doug Hall's Driving Eureka newsletter from December 20th, 2018. This week's featured story is titled Data Capture, A Secret to Agile Innovation Success. The Driving Eureka book segment discusses Dr. Deming's famous quote, "How could they know?" And in the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment, we'll talk about the need for data in a distillery and the craft cocktail recipe, the Solstice Sling. All right, Doug. So data capture, this is near and dear to my heart. You talked quite a bit about data capture in this segment. You say it's the secret to agile innovation success. And as we've talked in previous discussions, you know, it's still very fuzzy in my brain around how you get data out of something so foreign and nebulous as innovation.
Well, there's two parts to that. One part is data with regards to how to improve your innovation process so that your system gets smarter and more effective. And the other is data that you generate as a result of the ideas that you're working on. Okay, so in the first case, the data is important because we don't know that we're getting better. I mean, I see companies that, you know, maybe it's been 10 or 15 years since I've worked with them, management changes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I come back around and they're no different than they were 15 years ago. It's like they haven't gotten any smarter. They just keep doing the same, what they consider best practice, which is actually not even close to a best practice, because they have no measurement and they can't track, you know, whether it's cycle time, how fast does it take them to create and run tests, run a quantitative research study, as we've talked about, whether it's how many ideas they generate per brainstorming session that they have, whether it's how many customer contacts they're having when they work on an idea. In other words, some ideas I've seen, they've gone through and they've been working on it for 6 months. And I say, have you ever talked to a customer about this? They go, well, no, not yet. We're not ready to yet. I said, how do you even know what you're doing? I mean, and just simply measuring learning cycles, tests, number of people you some simple metrics will start to get you a sense as to where you're moving. And on top of that is the results of the test. Are your meaningful uniqueness scores, as we've talked, are they going up, going down, or staying the same? As simple as that. And so you can measure these things by just taking some time and thinking about it. What is the outcome that you're looking at, and what are the things that could cause that outcome?
Okay, so let's go back to a couple of these things. You talked about this concept of best practice. And I know as a consultant what you're talking about, because you seem to go into, you know, any organization out there and you kind of see the same patterns of thinking that are going on. And I don't know if they're taught in business schools or whether they're just logical outcomes of what organizations do. But what do you see that they're doing that you've labeled it a kind of their best practice? And it may be a series of things associated with it. What's in their brain about how they're going about innovation? Are they trying to protect their idea, and that's the reason they don't want to go out to customers? Or kind of what is it that you see?
I think it's even worse than that.
Oh,
I think it starts off with leadership. Leadership hasn't set a direction to say how they're going to win. Hmm. They haven't picked a direction. They've set an outcome, a metric, but they haven't said by what method, as Dr. Deming would say. They've not made a choice to say we're going to go right or we're going to go left or what we're going to do. And then in the absence of that, what they've tended to do is to become reactive. Sales says, well, competition's doing this. Customer's asking for this. Let's do this. And so they're always behind. They're always behind. As opposed to the alternative, which is proactive leadership, leading into the future, picking where they're going, setting a direction to it. And the simple, simple measure is, are you smarter than you were 6 months ago or 12 months ago? Is your system faster? Is it more efficient? And the fact of the matter, it isn't. And one of the root causes of that is the second part of data capture that I mentioned, which is the data generated as you start to work on projects. When you start to run experiments, when you start to run a test, I mean, people will run a series of maybe taste tests in the spirits business or whatever. And then you go back to them, and you say, can you summarize them for you? You say, well, they're actually in a whole bunch of different files. I mean, they don't even have them in a simple way to go get them. And as you start to go into development, which, let's face it, the front end of innovation is not the problem. It's all development. That's where half the value is lost, as we've talked. And in development, the amount of data that gets generated, whether it's specifications, whether it's regulatory stuff, whether it's bill of materials, whether it's costing information, the need to get that data right. And when teams start going faster, they usually start missing some of that. And one of the key reasons why they miss it is, now just follow me for a second. This is what I've seen in companies. I've seen in companies as much as a 97% error, critical errors, when they get to the end of the process and they're ready to go and they're going to fire this off into their SPSS, SAS, whatever it is, system. And that's going to get procurement to start buying and the factory to start building. And there's a critical error 97% of the time in that final data package. And the reason for it, when we've traced it back and we've mapped the system, when we've looked at it, what we found is the parts don't work together. In other words, in a corporation, especially in larger companies, but it happens in small ones too, is each department has their own forms, their own information. And they'll have their own. And sometimes there can be huge stacks of these that you have to fill out as you walk through the process of creating something new. And the problem is those parts are all interrelated. They're an interrelated system. But they're worked on as individual silos. And so what happens is you get working on the project. People are filling in their numbers just like Henry Ford's production line. They're doing their job. And then suddenly something comes up where we have to make a change. Oh, that's not going to work. We're going to have to change the cost, or we're going to have to change this vendor, or we're going to have to change the net weight, or we're going to have to change the percent alcohol in the case of our whiskey business. Well, if you're not careful, what happens is that change has a ripple effect into other departments and those other forms that are in the silos, and it gets missed. And it's a train wreck. It's an absolute train wreck, because what you have to do then is you have to go back through all of those forms to check. So this is a nightmare. So as a result, what we've done is the Eureka Ranch team has actually built in the new Trailblazer platform a data capture system. And this data capture system, with no custom programming, none of that big, huge bills, allows every or department to have their form in one place, in the same place, and all interrelated with others, so that when a change happens, you know that there's a change, and you can see the connection to the strategic mission, we call it the blue card, the customer offering, the yellow card, and the business model, the math. Because people make a change and don't realize they're having an impact on others. And this data capture, what I found is in development, it is the data flow. You know how in the money world where they say follow the money? No. I'm talking about follow the data. Follow the data. If you follow the data, you'll find that's where most of your speed problems and your errors are. It's in the data.
Okay, so you've said quite a bit there.
It's
good.
It literally was one of these things where the scales came from my eyes, and when I realized, because I like to create, so I'm kind of not into like the attention to detail stuff. But when I realized that was the flaw, I got religion on this one, brother. I got religion on the importance of documenting this process as you go along, because otherwise you end up with rework or, worse yet, massive mistakes.
Okay. So I got a few questions here, but I want to start with this 97% error, because it's as an executive sitting in an organization, it's going to be hard for me. You know, I've like you said, they're all silos. I may be the senior vice president over a particular silo, you know, and then I've got my sales guy, but I've got to be concerned with my pile of people and processes and things of that sort. So how am I, what are the 97% errors? What is that made up of? I mean, is it just the communication between the departments? Is it, you know, when I'm looking, how would I know I've got the problem?
Well, what you got to do is so first off, look in your organization and follow your data stream that goes into your automated purchasing conglomerate that goes into the fancy software. And look at the end at the person who releases it. And what you'll usually find is a department of people whose job it is to inspect and try to find the flaws. Hmm. There'll be a whole team of them. And when you go down in the bowels of, it's like going down into the engine room and you get down and you talk to them. These people are sitting there saying, I'm dying, man. This stuff's coming through. And it's exactly what you said. It's a non-interaction between the departments. It's person making a change and not realizing, not even knowing that it has an influence on something else that's going on. I mean, there's a whole lot of if-then things that happen. And you can't, with innovation, you know, people say, well, you should just program it so that it would automatically know it. Well, the problem is it's innovation. And innovation means it's new. It means we haven't done it before. And so, you know, people will look at it and say, well, is this like the way we normally do it? And this one isn't, but they don't know it. And so they act inappropriately and they put the wrong numbers in.
Okay. So now you've also then talked about the Trailblazer software. And I'm still in my head, it's still not clear as to, all right, now I've got it all coming into one place, but I had it coming into one place before in this department or in this area, you know, where it's being collected. What's the difference?
The difference is that there's usually separate systems. There's a data capture system. Somebody's running Microsoft Project. They've got a project management system. They've got briefs to creative groups that they're doing. They've got a purchasing procurement. They've got a financial spreadsheet. All of those things are different. What the ranch team has done is with the Trailblazer, it's project management for innovations for when there's variance in it. And so you manage your whole project and all of your data in one central place. In other words, one place. I know this is a miraculous idea. One place.
Okay. And so the Trailblazer software, I mean, it still doesn't seem like, are there things, all right, back up a little bit, Trip. When I look at this, there's all of these different pieces coming in. Now, I've got to believe that when you're going through this process of putting this information in the software, are you almost going through, is it almost like cleaning a room and you're saying, why do we have this? We don't need that. You know, coming into the system. I don't know what that might be. You might have a better idea, but are there things where you sit there and say, well, you don't even need that. Why is that? Why does somebody have to fill out a form or do something associated with that? Or do you not challenge that and just goes into the system?
Those are the exact things that happen. So let me just give you a simple example.
Okay.
You have to enter in a, so you've got a project number that's the SKU number or whatever it is, if it's a product company or if it's a software or whatever it might be. And you have to enter in maybe a key piece of information, maybe call it a retailer. It might be a UPC code.
Okay.
Well, you end up entering that number or net weights and percentages. You'll have to enter them multiple times in these systems usually.
Okay.
You enter it over here, you enter it over here, you enter it over here. And the problem is that you slip a number and nobody knows that you slipped a number. With this process, you enter a piece of data once, and then it replicates itself in the other places where the other forms have. So if I've got seven departments I'm working with, when I enter information, I've pre-filled the templates for all the other departments the same.
Ah, okay.
Always the same. And I always have the most recent version there, and I've got non-destructive editing, and then I can go back and see what the past one was and who changed it and how it got changed.
Okay.
So you've got some intelligence, not so much that it becomes stupidly expensive, because the normal thing on this is what I'm talking about is this is hundreds of thousands of dollars and, you know, just to do the programming, 9 to 12 months to do it. No, this literally, you can start this thing up next week and it's painless. because of the way the thing's been built.
I got it. Okay. So is there anything else that you want the audience to know about the Trailblazer software as far as data capture or anything else for that matter?
Well, I mean, the big thing is you got to think about your projects. So there's a love right now to bring in project management people. And I love project management people. The challenge is we have to get the project management people and all of us to think that there's a difference between projects with low variance that we've done many times before mm-hmm. and innovations that have a high variance and a high uncertainty to them. And when you have uncertainty, you can still do project management, but you have to build it in a way that you, while you have task completion, conformance to requirements, as they say, at the same time, you've got to have a system, a discipline system for managing plan, do, study, act, or fail fast, fail cheap cycles of learning. And it has to be both. It's sort of like freedom within a framework is what we're talking about. And so we need project management desperately because the creatives create their ideas and they love their ideas and they don't happen. But we need to figure out a way to work together. We need to bring those right brains with those left brains, but in a way that we manage to. I had a guy once who does lean product development. He came to me and a big client brought him to me and he said, they want to integrate this with you. And I said, okay, fine. He says, okay, so to do lean product development, what you need to do is you need to give me your absolute specs as to what you're going to make, and then I'll lean out the way we design it. I said, well, if I knew exactly what I was going to do, I don't need you. It's already done. It's new, damn it. He said, well, that doesn't make any sense. You have to make your decisions before I start development. I said, but I can't even figure it out until I start the development. And therein lies the absolute insanity that's going on right now. Everybody's spending time on the front end. Wrong place. That's not where the barriers are. The problem is in development. It's in our project management. It's in our data capture. These are boring, ugly things, but you do those. That's how you'll see your 6X, 600% increase in speeds. That's the problems. That's the barriers to you. And that's what we're working on fixing.
Okay, I got it. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book excerpt with legendary inventor Doug Hall. All right, well, let's move to our Driving Eureka book segment and discuss Dr. Deming's famous quote. How could they know?
Oh, geez, how now could you got they me know? Trip, you got me all wound up now. And now it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse because, you know, when you've seen, I mean, I've been doing this stuff for forever. Okay. And I love it. I so love it. But it frustrates me so much that we can't make it happen. And Dr. Deming, of course, the famous statistician, went to Japan, reinvented Japan, basically changed the world of business probably more than any other single person. Everything that happens with Lean, Six Sigma, quality that's done in the world was really sparked by him, building on the work of others. But this is the man that did it. And in the 80s, as we've talked, my dad worked with him when he first came back to the U.S. at National Corporation. And he was in his 80s when he came back, and he would get very frustrated with people. And people would say, well, Dr. Deming, shouldn't they know this? Shouldn't they know these things that you're telling them about reducing variation and enabling workers and all the such things and thinking about it as a system of interconnected parts? And he would rant. And I'm not going to do it justice. Maybe we can get the audio and we can stick it in here. Mm-hmm. Do you have the audio of this?
I don't, but I'm sure that it could be supplied.
Well, I'll read it, and then if you can use it, I'll do it both ways.
Okay.
So let's listen to how Dr. Deming says this. So Dr. Deming would say, when asked, shouldn't they know about it? He'd say, managers don't know about it. How could they know? How could they know? How could they know there was anything to learn? How could they? How could they? How could they know there was any other way to manage? The fact is, he's got a point. If you've never learned any other way of doing it, if you learned in school and then went up through the organization and became successful with a certain way of working, how would you even know there was another way to do it? And if most of your time is spent managing the existing business and now you're in charge of innovation, which is different, how would you ever know that that was possible? And the truth of the matter is that there are systems and there are methods that we can use, but we have to take the time to learn them. And that's the whole focus of the Driving Eureka book, is providing you with data-driven methods using the innovation engineering system to help you increase innovation speed while decreasing risk. But it's learning it's like a new language. It's a whole new way of thinking.
Okay. There's another quote in here that people that have worked with me, past, present, and I can safely say in the future, I hear all the time, or I'll re-say what they're saying with this phrase, which is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that's one of the common things that you hear quite a bit within organizations is, you know, why are you messing around with this? Because, you know, it's always worked this way and it works, you know, for me. And the problem is, and the challenge, I think, even as a consultant, is to get people to see that it's always been broken and that there's always, and in your case, that the thing that you brought to light for me is, well, that's right. There's always a better way to do it. And there's always a better way to do something. Meaning that you've got this kind of mindset and this system around that whatever you're doing today that's working great can still be better.
Well, and famously, you know, the folks in Cincinnati, you know, twice made this mistake. You know, all the horse and buggies were made in Cincinnati. It was the capital of all of them, you know, and this guy Ford and Dodge came down and said, dudes, would like to put an engine in one of those things here. You got some good patents on the horse and buggy, you know, we would like to, no, we're going to stay prudent, proper, practical. Nope. It ain't broke. We're going to stay with horses. Okay. Missed it by that much. And then it happened again. It happened again. Twice it happened. And I may not have the order here right. The federal government came and said, Cincinnati, you're the queen city of the West. You're the queen city of the West. You are the nexus. This is where all of, you know, that's why Cincinnati, I love making whiskey in Cincinnati, because it was the marketplace for whiskey from Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio, 70 distilleries in Cincinnati alone. The riverboats were where the market was made for whiskey, and then it was shipped down Ohio to the Mississippi and beyond. And so it was the place. And because of all of that rail traffic and equipment and their ability to load the boats and all this stuff and the marketplace and the buyers and sellers, the government came and said, you know, geez, you know, we want to put a rail yard out here and where all of the rail stuff would come in, as opposed to, you know, the boats. And the city fathers were, you know, prudent and proper, practical, said, no, we're going to stay with the riverboats. We think they're going to last a lot longer. And of course that ended up going to Chicago, making one of the biggest cities in the country. But other than that, you know, and you know, we just kind of missed it. So the fact of the matter is, if it isn't broke, you better be careful, because somebody's going to break it, just like we're doing with whiskey, making it with time compression now instead of making it last for 18 years in a warehouse. There's somebody out there somewhere who's going to say, you know, I understand that's the way it's done, but, you know, I think I can do it better than that. I think I can find a better way to make a product, make it taste better, whatever it might be.
Okay. All right. I wanted to throw that in there because, you know, that is a common thing, whether it's a process, you know, somebody says, well, it works really well today. You know, it's, well, it can always be better. And from your standpoint, it can completely change moving forward. And if you're not constantly, and as you stated earlier, proactively going after those things, you're going to wind up being left in the dust. And in one of the previous episodes, you know, we talked about the speed of change increasing, and people are just going to be left behind very quickly.
That's right. Lead or follow. I mean, those are your choices. Are you going to lead or are you going to follow? And lead is a lot more profitable.
This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we're going to take you behind the scenes on what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company like has never been done before. Okay, well, let's move to our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment. And we're going to talk about the need for data in a distillery and then our craft cocktail recipe. But, you know, we've talked about data before quite a bit. Tell me about data being used in a whiskey distillery or a spirits distillery.
Okay, so if you're thinking about creating a distillery, let me just tell you. Data and precision with managing your data is critically important. And the reason it's important is so that you don't go to jail. I'm serious. I'm really, really serious. Okay. The fact of the matter is you are selling, you know, when you sell spirits, the government has a very vested interest. They're your partner, whether you like it or not. Okay. And they want their taxes and they've got regulations. And so you've got to follow the rules. I was with a leader of one of the states, and he said he was shaking his head because we were talking about our systems and data capture and all the like things we're doing. He said, oh, my God. He says, would you please teach the others? And we're working on it. This is one of the ways we're doing that. Because he says 80% of the distilleries in my state are probably making breaking the law in a significant way, and they don't even know it. And one of the biggest issues is – they're not tracking their data. I mean, when you have a distillery and you make spirits or you bring spirits in, you have to track that liquid. You got to track all of that liquid, because now you can do R&D and you can have waste in manufacturing. That's fine. But, you know, when it leaves the distillery, the tax man in your province in Canada or your state and the feds, they want their money. That's just the way it is. And so you've got to be meticulous with it. And it's the same thing when it comes to doing your research. I mean, I understand you're an artisan, but you need to be an artisan who writes down the recipes.
Okay. And because you've worked with a couple of different distilleries before, what data seems to be missing from these? You know, as you mentioned that they could go to jail and they're probably breaking the laws. Is there something in particular that they seem to be missing?
I think the biggest thing they're missing is a mindset towards it. Mm. I mean, they think that they're basically, you know, if they're a home brewer or something, they think they're more like a chef just kind of winging it. And the fact of the matter is when you're now in business and you've got, you know, whether it's the government, your shareholders or whatever it might be, you've got to develop a mindset, and that's what comes from the plan, do, study, act mindset, which is and you need a platform, whether you're going to use the Trailblazer platform that we've got and that we're going to make available to craft people at a scholarship price, or whether you're using some other software. You've got to be capturing this data, and you've got to get a mindset of running tests and documenting what you're doing. Your sales system, your CRM system for managing your customer relationships that you're doing. You've got to get this discipline in early. Okay. We are in the process of doing a massive expansion and we did very well with this, but now as we've grown literally 10X this year, we grew literally 10-fold and the year coming up, we're about to grow another 10-fold, you know, that created, put tensions on us. And while we were really great at it at the beginning of the year, mm-hmm. by the end of the year, as business went up 10X, you tend to get sloppy on it. And mm-hmm. so we're making a new statement as we've done this new expansion. So to do the next run of growth is we've got to get even more disciplined with our data. Cause the bigger you get, the more missing something in data costs you and it can cost you a lot. So, in time, energy, and money.
So, Doug, is that because you've got new people coming in to help with the volume, or what seems to drive the chaos?
The volume of what's going through. In other words, just the throughput. In our case, the throughput of bottles and that's going on. You know, before, if you made a little mistake on your ordering or your numbers, it didn't have huge consequences. You could just run over to a warehouse and get some more. Now, all of a sudden, you need to bring pallets in if you miss it. Or, you know, the labels that you need are just bigger volumes. The whiskey that you need is just much, much bigger volumes that you have to go through. And so the attention to those details, you know, if it's a little – if you're small and this mistake costs you, you know, $500, it's regrettable, but you live with it. But when you get bigger, that same mistake, instead of $500, can be now $5,000 or $10,000. And now it's ouch. You know, the consequences are just much bigger. Estimating your costs. You got to get them really good. You've got to get so many people I talk to. I say, what's it cost to make whiskey? And they say a number. And I go, well, first off, I know you're wrong, because there's no way on earth that you can do that. And even the biggest companies in the world can't do it for what you just said, because you haven't put in all the rest of the math. You haven't done all the rest of the things. Now, there are some good systems in distilling. There are some wonderful distilling systems that we use that integrate with our project management stuff and our accounting systems. But you got to have some systems, but it's got to be in the people. It has to be in your people. That's just – I don't do math. I don't write stuff down. Sorry, you don't work for me. End of story. Not interested. It's the only way we can work together, Trip.
Yeah.
If it's not written down, it's not – I mean, we have – even my guy that does R&D who's very artistic, Philip, he's incredible. He's incredible, okay? Incredible palette. And we got him writing down all of his experiments in the Trailblazer software, and he would put down what he learned, and he'd run his plan, do study, act cycles. And he, you know, was a little hesitant at first, but now he does it and he says, oh, man, it's so helpful to me because it forces me to think through what I just did. Now, as a bonus, it also comes to me, who's the CEO of the company, and wherever in the world I might be, three times a day I get a notification with all of the updates that's on it and I can comment on them. So it allows us to keep going faster, to pivot, to adjust and adapt because of that collaboration. But we can't read minds, so we have to read words. You know, that's the best way we found.
That's great. That's but it, like you said, it is a discipline that we seem to have, especially whether it's R&D people or marketing people. They don't really, they resist it, and yet when they adopt it, they seem to like it, which is there's great irony there associated with kind of that mindset.
Well, it gets back to, is this about creativity or is this about innovation, which is productive imagination? Are we here to try to ship something, make a difference in the world, or are we doing art for art's sake? I love art, but that's not what we're doing here. You know, we're trying to make a business out of these things.
Absolutely. Well, let's move to your craft cocktail recipe, the Solstice Sling. And it looks like this may be one of your early inventions for craft cocktails.
Yeah, so this is actually from Philip, who's the magician at our place who leads R&D. And I challenged him to come up with a winter cocktail. This was originally built for the Eureka Ranch holiday party and the distillery party. And it's a kind of a neat twist on a gin cocktail that it's the same time classy and elegant. And so in a shaker, what you're going to do is you're going to put together 1.5 ounces of gin, 1.5 tablespoons of pear puree, which you make by just, you know, cooking some pears with a little water and then putting them in a blender. So it's going to be a little bit chunky for you, just to soften them up. A tablespoon of rosemary syrup, some simple syrup that you've let some rosemary soak in it. 1/2 teaspoon of lemon juice, fresh lemon juice, and 1/2 teaspoon of white balsamic. And you top it with some sparkling water and garnish with rosemary and lemon. So this is a real craft concoction. This is out there. This is not some of the simple ones that we've been doing. this is the kind of thing that you'd pay extras for. And it's just got the lightness of the pear with the rosemary, brings out some of the notes in the gin. Some of the spice notes of the gin start to come out, and it's just magical. It's a magical taste.
So let me ask you this, Doug, because you're so specific sometimes about some of the items that are being used. Is the shaker matter? Is it a Boston shaker, or is it going to be any shaker? Or see you got the 12 seconds. You got me. I know. It's like after you've been smacked in the face six times, you know, you start to ask these questions.
So, okay, go ahead and fess up. What happened to you on the martini recipe?
I didn't have the right shaker to begin with. So that was the first disaster that I had.
Didn't
with the
taste
martini.
The same, did
no,
it?
No, it didn't. And I have to admit, it did not. Once I got the Boston shaker and was able to.
Well, describe it to people so they know what we're talking
about. Well, okay. So in an earlier episode, we talked about a martini, and Doug took me through a very.
Not a martini, no,
the
martini.
The martini. Sorry. Yes, absolutely. So I'm already being corrected. But Doug is very prudent about this when he is prudent about nothing that I've ever noticed before. But you had to have the Beefeater's gin because, you know, and now you've got me, so I'm remembering these things. Like I said, get smacked across the face. A few times, and you start to say, okay, now why am I doing this? So we got the Beefeater's gin because it has less sugar in it than other gins. I remember that. And then you had the Dolan dry vermouth that you put in. You got to put in a cap full, and I used the wrong cap the first time. That was another disaster.
I used
the Beefeater cap by accident. They were both sitting there, and I grabbed one. Missed it by that much. And it's not that, you know, these are small differences. And then I had, I forget what the type of shaker that I has, but it's a strainer in the top. But regardless.
And the Boston shaker is the two-part one.
Right.
It has
right.
the glass and then the silver one that you'll see that you put together and then you shake it. And it creates a greater flow, throw for it. And so the ice in that, you get to the proper dilution when you do it that way. When you use the little shakers, you just don't get the movement. And so you don't get the right dilution and you don't get the ice interaction that you need. It's just not nearly as good.
No, and it was. It's an interesting difference between, I mean, people, I'm just going to suggest that they try it. You know, it's worth the entertainment, if for nothing else, to get the Boston shaker and to have it shaken for the 12 seconds or whatever. But let me get back to the Solstice Sling.
Yeah.
Does it require a Boston shaker, number one?
Oh, well, I don't even explain after that. It's always
it's always going to be the Boston shaker. Okay.
Never.
All
right. They're either stirred or shaken. And if it's shaken, it's always
a Boston,
shaker.
Okay. All right.
And if it's stirred, which, you know, bond, shaken, not stirred, you can stir as well. You can try it that way and try it and see what see the difference. See the difference, what you do. Oh, come on. It's a cheap thrill. It's not a huge and besides, after you taste four or five of them, it's going to be more fun.
Well, you know, and then you got the guests out there doing the 12-second countdown with you, too.
That's right.
So, and then also on this drink, the gin, does it matter which gin for this drink, for the Solstice Sling?
Less so this one, but I would keep it to a London Dry. Or a Plymouth. I wouldn't go to some of the boutique-y ones because a lot of those have too much sugar in them and it's going to take it over the top. So I would tend to keep it to a dry. I tend to use the dry stuff all the time. And then I add my sugar back in through the syrup so I can control it more. Gin, so just so listeners know, gin and rum has sugar added. You can legally add sugar. I mean, just like sugar. It is what it is. No, it doesn't come in from the cane sugar. No, it's added sugar. You add sugar to gin and rum. That's legal too. A London Dry is not supposed to have it. It actually can have, I think, 0.5% or something like that, sort of softened it. There's a tiny, tiny amount in it. Mm. But that's the reason why some gins taste good and some gins don't. The idea of a gin was you would add the vermouth, that even the dry vermouth has sweetness to it, and that's what brings the sweetness in. As opposed to when I have craft gins, I'll usually just have them over ice most of the time just because they've already got the sweetness in. It's not vermouth. It's a different taste, but they've already put the sweetness in it.
Okay. All right. Well, that ends our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment, and we'll look forward to the next drink that you have for us, and probably next time we'll get an update on how the distillery's coming, too.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you, Trip.
Thank you. Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for a limited time four things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.